Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How are you tonight?
Marvelous. Better than I deserve to be.
Better than you deserve.
Absolutely.
That implies that if you didn't deserve it, it would be worse.
So it means that I'm just fortunate to be as well as I am. Just go to the hospice and the nursing homes and all the places where people are in such bad condition. So when you put it in the context of how people are living and then in the developing world, we're just so fortunate to be in the situation most of us are in, despite our hardships.
I agree. If you're listening to us via the website, we're delighted to have you, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or TuneIn. If you like what you hear, please write a review. And if you don't, just forget everything I just said. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Even a dollar contribution would be appreciated endlessly. Larry, we have a whole bunch of news items. Even had to start filtering some out. But, so, the first one on the list is from the Washington Post. He was arrested for a sex act that no longer is a crime. Years later, he remains convicted. Green was 20 when he was arrested after having oral sex with a 16-year-old male in a Georgia hotel room. He was convicted of a sex crime. Was it consensual? It was. Was it because the partner was underage? No. In fact, in Georgia, it was 16 at the time. He was convicted because the incident happened in 1997 when oral and anal sex between consenting adults was prohibited under Georgia sodomy law. The conviction requires him to register as a sex offender, a stigmatizing label that he has carried for years. So the question, I think this is ex post facto, but kind of backwards, where they can't add stuff to you. But if you're convicted of something back in the day and now it's no longer a crime, does it stick with you?
This is one of your greatest questions of all time, Andy. There's so much in this. There's so many issues wrapped up in this. So we can try to unpack some of them. You have, more frequently, laws are changed to make them more harsh and to make things crimes that are not. But occasionally you have the reverse of what has happened. And this was our evolving standards of decency and judicial rulings have rendered a Georgia law archaic, which was also on many states, including, I think, California one time, which was sodomy. Georgia was a pretty broad prohibition on sodomy. It could be applied to heterosexuals as well. It wasn't gender specific. But what's happened is that law is no longer enforceable, but people were convicted under it. So it creates a new dilemma for what do you do with the people that were convicted under the law when it was a law. Those convictions were valid at the time, because the laws had been duly enacted and they had been presumed to be constitutional, and people were prosecuted under those laws and there's convictions on their records. So that is the problem when those laws come off the books, which this one was through judicial intervention. There's no mechanism to bring those convictions off people's records. So then you have a brand new set of problems. And for this person, it's the sex offender registry that's causing the biggest problem.
So it is kind of ex post facto in reverse, though.
It is. The Georgia legislature, had they removed this law from the books in a way that had specified that they wanted to repeal it and to provide relief for anyone who had been convicted for a specified period of time, they could assume that at a certain point they would be dead, and they probably wouldn't need the relief. But they could have done that, but they chose not to, because if they had chosen to do that, it would have opened up in a very expensive process of identifying and providing that relief, and it would have been clogging the judicial system. So it's their old proverbial floodgates that they would have been worried about. So they just simply said, we don't enforce it any longer, and then they hope that everybody who's had the convictions just realizes, well, you're fine now. You can do that all you want to now, but it doesn't take care of this person and many others out there that have the convictions on their record.
1997 isn't that long ago.
Nope, 21st year now.
Yeah, so I mean, this person is only the the perpetrator is only, you know, 40-ish, 41 years old. So he's still got 40, 50 years left, and he's going to have to live under something that's no longer illegal, but still be a convicted felon and sex offender, ostensibly. What would be the recourse for someone to do that? Do you have to hire a lawyer to do what? What would be the process to have that undone?
Well, he tried a number of processes. I've read the article that you brought to the show, and I read the article. He tried a number of processes, but he didn't gain any traction in terms of his registration obligation. If it were me in that position, I'd want to get that off my back as quickly as possible.
Certainly.
So since Georgia is one of those states that does provide a removal mechanism to petition for removal, it would strike me as very odd that since this law has been declared unconstitutional and it's been removed from the arena of valid enforcement, it would stand to reason to me that petition would be granted. So that would be one mechanism for him to consider, would be to try to get himself removed through the removal process and cite in the petition that what he was convicted of is no longer a crime. And he may have already done that and failed. We don't know that. That wasn't in the article.
And is that what's considered a blue law?
I think the blue laws are more related to the if I remember right, people operating businesses on Sunday, and that was offensive to the I guess I don't want to be too offensive here, but that was offensive to people who had certain religious beliefs that this Sunday was a day of rest.
Right. I guess I'm asking. I have heard. I have no evidence to back this up, but say eating chicken with a fork on Wednesday. I think that's called a blue law, and I'm wondering if this fits into something like that.
I'm not sure it does, but this guy has got real problems because he's tried so many remedies and they failed in terms of relief, and it went all the way to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a federal circuit court. There's only 11 circuits in the country. And he's taken his claim there, and he was denied relief at the 11th Circuit. Unfortunately for him, that was probably the correct decision from the circuit from a legal perspective, although it's not a desirable outcome. But he used a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, and he's not in custody. And in order to use that particular corrective measure, a person has to be in a form of custody, and the federal system defines custody a little more broadly than several states, but they have not, it has not been defined broadly enough to include registration as custody. He has no other restrictions resulting from this old conviction.
Right.
So he's not in supervised, unsupervised, or any type of probation. He's not in physical custody. So he doesn't meet the expanded definition of federal custody. So therefore, this claim in a habeas proceeding was not cognizable. So therefore, he was denied habeas relief, although there were people who were rooting for him. I think the lower court granted habeas relief, if I remember right. But then the 11th said, no, that's wrong. That's not a cognizable claim. So he didn't get the habeas relief. So he's run out of options. He's filed a number of things through the Georgia court system. So he would really need to consult with a Georgia practitioner that really understands their process and see if there's anything else he can do. But a removal petition would certainly be an option if he hasn't done that already and failed.
But okay, if we were to make murder legal, or any crime, if we were to make it legal, but at the time that you did it, it was still illegal, you're still guilty of a crime. They don't undo it. You're still a convicted felon for the thing that was at one point illegal. So he possibly is off the registry at this point, and you know, he's just served his time. So I mean, I see where you, I see the logic behind what you're saying, of that he's run out of options, that the 11th Circuit said no, you should still be listed as a convicted felon.
Well, that is I think what they did say. I didn't have the opportunity to read the full opinion, but he, that is correct. If you've been convicted of a crime that was a crime at the time, it doesn't magically become a non-conviction later.
Right, right.
So he's got a conviction, and this has played out in Georgia before. There was a case, I think about 10, 12 years ago, of a football player named Gennaro Wilson, who was sentenced to 20 years, either 10 or 20 years in prison for having consensual sex with a high school student. He was a high school student himself. They were both high school students. He was the older of the students. And he was sentenced to an extremely long period of time in prison. There may have been some racial bias in it because he was black and the student was the younger student was white. But he got his conviction overturned because the Georgia Supreme Court said that to apply that harsh of a punishment on a 17-year-old for a consenting act crossed the threshold of what they considered cruel and unusual punishment. So Gennaro gets his conviction set aside because it's cruel and unusual punishment. And then the Georgia Assembly comes in and changes the law going forward so that it's only a misdemeanor for people in that age bracket, in that zone of ages. And I don't know if I can recall exactly the ages that they made it just a misdemeanor to engage in consensual sex. But that left hundreds, if not thousands, of people convicted of the more serious crime, many of them serving time. And the Georgia Attorney General at the time was Thurbert Baker. And Mr. Baker said that we can't go back and turn all those people loose.
Right.
He said that would be a gargantuan task to identify all those people. So, but you know, it's funny how they can identify them real quickly when they want to increase registration periods. They can identify them very quickly, but they didn't want the task of, as far as I know, that whole bunch of people that were convicted of that more serious crime remain convicted and serve their time as it was really originally imposed. I don't believe they got any relief. So if we could do a little digging, maybe on a future podcast, if we find out that I'm wrong, we can correct that, because I always want to be giving out accurate information as best we can.
Absolutely. So moving on from the American press, and this one's short, but it's just a sad, sad story. No housing options for sex offender. A requirement for Mr. Ellender's release is a housing plan that complies with the guidelines set for sex offenders. Ellender has been in jail since 2015 and has no place to live if he is released. So he stays locked up. Is there anything else like that under any other crimes or regulations that if you are just not in compliance, that you just go sit in the jailhouse?
Well, yes, there is. And my state is filled with prisons approaching 1,000 people in of our 7,000 inmate prison population of people we identify as being release eligible, meaning that they've served all the time they owe the state of New Mexico, but they can't be released because they don't have a viable housing plan. So the onus is on the offender in order to go into this post-prison period of time that's mandated. See, they've served all their time. They don't owe the state any more in-house incarceration. They've served all their time. But until they have an approved residence where they can be supervised for their two-year period, or most felons, it's a two-year period for sexual offenses, it's an indeterminate period. But since they don't have an approved place of residence, they continue to languish in prison for additional time. So that is not an uncommon thing. It happens across the country. Suitable housing is difficult to come by. It happens more, I think, of that 1,000 we have, a significant number of them are those for sex offenses. So they're disproportionately represented, but it's not exclusive to sexual offenders.
To expand on that, because, and maybe not in your state, I don't think you have living restrictions there, but many states they do. So you could have a friend or relative that's willing to put you up, but it's within 1,000 feet of some no-go zone. So then you're stuck, and that costs the state, you know, the numbers vary, but $20,000 or $30,000 a year to house you. That's a mess.
Well, actually, we do have restrictions.
Oh, you do?
Under supervision. If they're under supervision.
Okay, right.
Yeah, they're imposed by the supervising authorities. So that creates a lot of the problem, because housing would otherwise be approvable except for the 1,000-foot restriction for the various things that they encircle. So it's an enormous cost to the state, and some of our lawmakers have called out the executive branch on it, saying, hey, we're spending millions of dollars on housing people that are release eligible. It would make more sense from an economic point of view to channel that money into community facilities.
Yeah,
because they're cheaper to operate in the community. But then you get into a whole political argument about who wants a reintegration center in their community. It's difficult to locate such facilities.
Yep.
And then you're mollycoddling criminals because they should be paying their own way. So the taxpayers are willing to pay the cost of locking someone up in a secure facility, but they're not so willing to pay the cost of locking people up and supervising them in a community center because that's just too darn cushy.
Yeah.
And it's a mindset we have to overcome. But I've always wondered, even a step beyond that, so let's just pull the 30,000 figure. State correctional systems vary across the country.
Yes.
Some states are very, very frugal, and they keep their costs down by using a lot of inmate labor, growing crops, and manufacturing. Some states are higher, the cost of living and the cost. But let's just pull out something in the $30,000 range. I wonder if we told a person, well, we're going to release you from prison, and it costs $30,000 a year to house you. It costs $2,800 a year to supervise you in the community. So we're going to give you the difference in that amount as a stipend.
On condition
that you don't commit any crimes. And we will be testing you, monitoring you in an intensive fashion. But in order that society be safe, we would like to incentivize you not to commit a crime. And while you're getting this incentive, you have to go to school. You have to do things with yourself to earn the stipend. I wonder if that approach would be a positive direction to take, because if we're willing to spend $30,000 a year to punish them with hard labor and tough conditions, why wouldn't we be willing to try something different and see if a non-American model could work? Because I know America is the smartest at everything, and we do things better than anybody else in the world. But we tend to have more of a crime problem, the highest incarceration rate in the nation or in the world. Our country ranks up to the top on the incarceration rate per 100,000 citizens. So wouldn't it be worthwhile to try some experiments like that?
I actually used to have a very developed conversation with someone about building those kind of places. And I know I'm going to totally get ridiculed for this, Larry, but I developed this whole thing of having, you could take like an old National Guard base or something of that sort, where you have barracks and dormitories and all this stuff. And you could put people there and you could have them go through training. You could provide some level of possible like daycare for kids if they're a single parent or something like that. And it would be a very, it would be a concentrated effort to retrain them, so to speak, and have a different way of thinking. I just had this idea of figuring out a way to get the people that are, they have lower educations, they need help, they need a way to get out of the mindset of being of a criminal mindset and into a mindset where they are going to at least cover a portion of their load into society instead of 30 or whatever that number is per year. Fine, the guy makes minimum wage or the gal makes minimum wage. That's $16,000 a year. That's half. Give them a little bit of stipend with some food stamps, etc. And you get them some training. Maybe they can go into welding, whatever that direction is.
But, you know, that type of model could be something for, we have a severe homeless problem in this country, and we've got a lot of abandoned military facilities, and we've got housing stock. Housing stock is short, and it's oversupplied depending on where you are. So
right.
People that are listening to us in California, they're thinking, what kind of nuts are we talking about, extra housing stock? But even in California, there's repossessions and there's a lot of housing stock that's not it. But if you go back in the Midwest in the old industrial heartland, there's a ton of housing stock that's just going to waste and boarded up and decaying and falling apart and really degrading what was great American cities. So we've got ways that creative ways. It requires the will, though. We have to rethink how we do things, and we have to admit that everything that we've done has not been ideal in terms of the outcome. And that's difficult because we like to dig at our heels and think we do more of it. We bear down more. And if we just throw a little bit more money at what we're doing now, it's going to somehow work.
Yes.
So if we lock up more people, prosecute more people, we can build our way out of this. So
this is a sunk cost fallacy. We've spent so much money on the system we have. We can't imagine trying to just say, let's just declare a bankrupt system and try something new from scratch. But since we have all this money and resources and labor and so forth invested in the system that we've created, we cannot get our minds to go in another direction.
Well, it is interesting that we can't get our minds to go in a different direction when it comes to certain types of things. When it comes to law enforcement, prisons, and military, we can't redirect our old mindset. Yeah, we're still in a Cold War mentality. We can't redirect ourselves. But when it comes to some social programs, now we've redirected our mind on a lot of things about social program. We ended welfare as we know it in 96, replaced it with TANF. We're constantly tinkering with means-tested programs to tighten the eligibility and require work. I mean, the states are now looking at, they're getting the green light from the administration to impose work requirements on Medicaid recipients. So it's okay. When it's a social program, they say all you liberals want to do is throw more money at a failed system, and you don't understand we need to try to do things differently. But yet, magically, when you jump over to the other side on things for, they don't apply that same standard. In our state, where the crime rate has been rising, if they applied the same standard that they applied to their thinking on social needs, we would scrap the Department of Corrections because we have a very high recidivism rate. So it seems like to me, rather than giving the Corrections Department an 8.5% raise and millions of more dollars this year, that it seems like to me we would have told them, look, all you're wanting us to do is throw more money into a failed system. You've not rehabilitated anybody. You've not cut the recidivism rate. You have been a dismal failure. And all you're asking us to do is to keep pouring more and more money into a failed system. It's what they say to us when we want more money for things that are including education. They say, why do you just want to keep dumping more money into a failed system? Our graduation rate is in the lowest the nation. We have all these problems, and all you guys want to do is just to throw more money in it. Why don't you try charter schools? Why don't you try vouchers? Why don't you people try something different rather than throwing more money in a failed system? And I'm signing up for that. I'm agreeing with you. Why don't you apply that to the other side on things that you support?
Right, right.
they never see that they're disconnected from reality when it comes to things they support. Well, money's the answer.
But everybody does that. It's not just left or right. People, it is it's motivated reasoning. You agree with the way that you work, therefore you will come up with the reasons behind the way you work and justifying what you do.
Is that right?
That's totally what that is.
Well, I'm just simply employing their logic.
I agree with you.
I'm simply saying I'm sold on your logic. You say don't throw more money into a failed system. I've bought in. Okay, let's not throw any more money into your failed systems either.
Sure. But is it a zero-sum game on both sides? Is it, hey, I agree that my side is failing. You have to pony up one of your sides that's failing? Do we have to have a tit-for-tat?
I don't think it's a tit-for-tat. I'm saying that you have espoused a belief system that if a system's failing, throwing more money into it's not the answer. And you don't want to give me any more money for education because it's a failed system. You don't want to give me any more money for a number of things because it's a failed system. And I'm saying, okay, I'm sold.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give you any more money for your fail system.
Sure.
That you're asking for more money. And all of a sudden, once you buy into their logic, it no longer applies to things they want more money for. That's what confuses me.
I completely understand. So what's the solution to all of that?
They sell you on their strategy, and then they don't want to follow it when you buy in.
Right. Well, they don't want to follow it from their side. They want to take away from you. And hey, so it would be like, hey, it's one for me, one for you, two for me, one for you, three for me, one for you, four for me, one for you. You ready to move on?
Sure.
I don't remember when this story came out, but there was the athlete up in Oregon, and I don't remember like the nexus of the story, but something about him being a sex offender and he gets dumped from the team. And so here, and I'm hoping that you have some history of it.
He didn't get dumped. He did not get dumped. To the credit of the Oregon State University, they have steadfastly stood with him.
Okay.
So.
But here's an update to it though, and he doesn't necessarily have all the support. So this is from Yahoo Sports. Oregon State left-hander Luke Heimrich returned to baseball, the baseball diamond on Friday, helping to lead his ball club to a 5-2 win against New Mexico. Uh-oh, Larry. Those are your people. It was the first time Heimlich had pitched a game since last June, when he removed himself from Oregon State's College World Series bound team to avoid becoming a distraction. Everybody, most of the time, deserves a second chance. I get that, an anonymous athletic director told CBS Sports. Heimlich went through his counseling, but it was a six-year-old child. You've got little girls coming to your games. You can't really have that image with your program, with Larry Nassar and all those things going on. Really? You just have to say, I'm sorry, young man, you can't play for us. Those are some comments that some people left in the article. And so this goes back to something we've discussed. I don't know how old he was when the event occurred, but we've covered before. Can you never live past your past? Can you ever break free from it?
Not in America. You can't. But I don't remember his exact age, but he was a juvenile. And what happened was he was adjudicated as a juvenile, which resulted in a sealed record. But he still had to register as a sex offender with that juvenile conviction. Now, see, had he chosen to have been born in my state, we don't register juveniles, so he wouldn't have had that issue here. But he had to register as a sex offender. So the Washington Supreme Court, I believe it was, where his conviction originated from, they decided that under their statutory scheme, that the list, regardless of whether they were released publicly, everybody in Washington on the registry is not released publicly. They have a system where you can have a level that doesn't put you in the public domain. But they decide if you request the list, that under their interpretation of the Freedom of Information, their equivalent, that he would be a citizen would be entitled to that list. So what happened was that someone acquired the list, and then they did the correlation mm-hmm. to Luke, and they released, and word got out that he was registering, and he's registering on what was a private list mm-hmm. until someone got the list and publicized it. And then it created a brouhaha last year at the university, and they have steadfastly supported him. They have said we would like him to continue to be a part of the university community here. But with all the hate mail and ugly stuff that's happened to him, he's not been really excited about playing with the adverse. He has a distraction,
yeah,
and he realizes that.
He was at least like a first round draft pick to go to the majors, I think.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I think he was in the rotation for drafting. I'm not sure he was drafted yet. I think he's still in school, but he had that potential. But this may be such a distraction that no major league baseball team is going to want this kind of distraction. I mean, as he's traveling, he's got registration obligations at the team. I mean, he would be a major distraction to a traveling baseball team.
And we also covered an article in the last week or two talking about Oregon passing a law where you have to self-disclose if you are a sex offender.
Well, that's to be a student at an institution of higher. Wasn't that what that was about?
Yeah, it was. If you're going to be a college student, you have to self-disclose.
That's driven by this case here.
Absolutely.
Because, see, he would not have come to light, but for the research that was done by someone obtaining the list, because the list was ordered to be public by the court, even though it was supposed to be a private list.
Can we dig into the sealing record thing, juvenile part of this for a minute? That why would you and why wouldn't you have sealed records for juveniles?
Well, it's kind of the same argument for everything else in the justice system. Why would you? It's because there's no way to move past your juvenile mistakes if the records are available, because people are not going to give the benefit of the doubt. They're going to say, well, he was 13 years old, but he ought to have known better. So the consistently around the country, some states more than others, they really focus on rehabilitation and saving the juvenile. Their entire purpose of the model of justice in many states is to rehabilitate. So part of that rehabilitation is to let that youngster move past that mistake that they made at an undeveloped age, an undeveloped mind. But the counter argument to that is that we've got these heinous crimes that have been committed by these little monsters, and they as an employer, I have the right to know that. so that I can make wise decisions. And you're asking me to hire a person who did some heinous act when they was 14, and I don't get to know about it. And then you're going to sue me later because of something he did. He wasn't rehabilitated. In our state, for example, you completely exit the system on your 18th birthday. So if you're adjudicated as a juvenile, the CYFD's jurisdiction ends when you're, that's Children, Youth, and Families Department ends upon reaching 18. So you've got these people who could have had a very short period of rehabilitation. They could have been an older teenager, but then when they move on out of the CYFD custody, all this stuff is no longer readily available to people. And that's the argument is that we need to know that. We have the right to know.
I don't
agree with that argument, but that's the argument.
Can we move this in the other direction? If you are qualified to do something terrible to where they're going to try you as an adult, can you also then petition the court to treat you as an adult so that, say, you could register when you're 14 or 15 years old? Why don't we do that?
Register for what?
Register to vote or shoot, join the military. I mean, why? It sounds the same.
Well, it does, but that's one of our intellectual dishonesties. You will hear hard-nosed prosecutors all the time say that I'm protecting the children. I'm doing these. They justify their harsh sentences that they seek to protect the children. But you let a young person under 18 commit a crime, and you watch how quickly they forget about protecting the children, and they go gung-ho and say that person knew better and that they deserve the harshest. They did the crime. They should do the time. They deserve the same punishment as if they were adult. The same people that claim that they're doing this for the children rapidly flip-flop when it comes time to prosecute them. There are states in this country where you can put people that are 14, 15 years old in adult prisons.
Yes.
It's sad. You know, that doesn't happen here, but it does happen, to my understanding, in the states in our country. There's an age where you can be waived up as an adult. In our state, the standard is very high to try someone as an adult. There has to be an evidentiary hearing, and the state has to prove that there's no treatment available anywhere in the state, and that kid's not amenable to any treatment that's available anywhere in the state. So they seldom succeed here, where in states, particularly in the South, they just simply file a piece of paper that says I'm moving this case to adult court, and it's just that simple. The prosecutor makes the decision. I'm trying that kid as an adult. Prosecutor doesn't get that. We don't trust the prosecutors here to make that decision by themselves, because we know that that decision would have motivations that would not be in the best interest of greater society. So we have a little higher standard, quite a bit higher standard.
Right. So if you do something bad, it's just over. I still can't figure out how. What would be the end game of what is desired? I get that someone says you did something horrible, you shouldn't be here. Okay, but if you're not here, then the other person says you shouldn't be there. Somebody else says you shouldn't be there. Next thing you know, you have to go find some deserted island. And is that the intent? To me, I can work that all the way to the point where if you steal a pencil from the local drugstore, it's a death sentence. It doesn't seem very hard for me to work that way all the way out.
I'll give you the answer that I give consistently. In a country like America, if we live up to our values, when a person has paid their debt to society that was extracted from society, there should not be excluded from anything. If they screw up again, we will prosecute them again. Luke has every right to play baseball. He's paid his debt to society in full. For that offense that happened at whatever age it happened, he's done. If these people who claim that they believe in redemption and second chances, if they would look at themselves in the mirror, Luke has paid his debt. What more do you want from him? I mean, obviously, I know the answer to that. What more you want is for his life to be ruined and for him not to have a future because he made this one mistake when he was a youngster. But he's paid for it. When is enough enough?
Right, and we covered that with...
We need to each look ourselves in the mirror and decide, when do we think a person has paid their debt? Do we believe that they've their debt to society when they've served the entirety of their sentence imposed by the court, or do they believe that they should get to decide to heap additional punishment on after the justice system has done its thing? And I think that the latter is what people believe, that they should be able to continue punishing them, because that's what these people that are calling for him to be kicked off the team and these comments that are posted, that's who those people are.
Right. Right. And let one of those things happen to them or a friend, and perhaps they would have a slightly different opinion. Do you think that's what it is? Do you think that these people are so far removed from it happening to them or a family member that they have no ability to have empathy?
I think it's probably a little deeper than that. I think we've gotten so self-absorbed in America and so uncaring and unforgiving that we can't overcome that he made a mistake.
Right.
But that doesn't define him for a lifetime. A childhood mistake should not define Luke for the rest of his life.
And that would be if he did more heinous things, you go back and they would be able to get those records, even though they're sealed for practical purposes of him being a juvenile. But so, hey, look, you did this before. Now you're here again. So now you are a recidivist. And then if you do it a third time, whatever. But don't the victim advocates then jump up and down and go, hey, we could have saved one if this person had been, I don't know, put on a boat and then drop a nuke on it? I mean, what are you supposed to do?
That's what they would say, is that it's always easy when a person has a second, when they have a relapse. But then the answer logically would be just to lock everyone up for the remainder of their life, regardless of the mistake, and be done with it. Of course, we would run out of people to lock if we did that. The lockers would be in short supply if we locked up everybody for life. But people will continue to fail. We're mortals, and we're flawed. And there's a variety of reasons why people recidivate. And we couldn't cover in one program all the reasons, but some people will fail. This is an offense where the recidivism rate is very, very low. Extremely low. Only murderers have a lower rate of recidivism.
Right. Moving on. From the Herald Republican, sex offender registries level stiff penalties. Noble County Superior 1 Court Judge Robert Kirsch believes the county trial courts, prosecutors, and judges should be given discretion on who should register and how long they must be able to. How long they must abide by the strict rules of the registry. Why have we taken the sentencing away from judges to determine the appropriate punishment? We fuss that judges legislate from the bench. Shouldn't we also fuss that judges' hands are tied in handing out sentences? And so here it sounds like we have a judge who wants to take the reins back in sentencing someone. And there were some examples in the article of almost like debtor's prison, where you just, you know, you end up with a taillight out and you can't afford to pay the fine. And then you end up in jail. Now you've lost your job. And it just cascaded down. And then one of the examples in there was a couple, and they were convicted of sexual conduct in the presence of their children. And when you have a newborn at home, pretty much guarantee you, you've got the kid in a crib in the bedroom and mom and dad get a little frisky. DFACS people would see that as like, oh my God, you're having sex in front of your kid. You're ruining them for life. And they're going to come take your kid away.
Well, I think that's a little bit of an extreme case that DFACS would come in. For those of you who are not in Georgia, that's the Department of Family and Children Services. But
if the kid's 10 years old and walks in on you, and then you go to school and you tell your teacher, you're like, I saw daddy putting his park in the car in the garage, and you're going to have problems. I don't know what their particular crime was, but it just says that they had sexual conduct in the presence of their children.
So, well, that the article didn't go into that. But what was very interesting was that Judge Kirsch, apparently in Indiana, where this story is from, apparently the judges run for election.
Okay.
And he's willing to say that even though he has to run for election. So that's really, really shocking that he would take a position that way.
The angle that I wanted to get with you on was about taking the sentencing away from judges and having that legislated versus the converse of that, where everyone went bonkers about the judges legislating from the bench about same-sex marriage.
So, well, there's a little nuance about this, because the registry is not a sentence.
True.
The court,
that's right.
most situations, merely apprised the person that this offense is going to result in an obligation to register. I think what Judge Kirsch is saying is that he would actually like to have that discretion to determine if that person should have to register.
Right.
Because he's in the best position as a judge to know the facts and determine how long a period of time and under what conditions. So I think he's saying that rather than it being a blanket that everybody has to fit within this very harsh registry regime, that the court should be empowered to look at each individual case. Well, I agree with Judge Kurtz. Of course, I don't agree that registry should exist.
Right.
But if we're going to have a registry, I would like it not to be a one size fits all. Everybody has to register. Is it legislating from the bench in reverse? Is that your question?
Yeah, it seems like we have one group of people that complain that judges legislate from the bench, and the legislators have taken they have taken the ability for the judges to provide any discretion in the sentences. And then this is the other way, where the judge is actually advocating for legislating from the bench.
So I think it's more of a judicial discretion thing that he's saying, that he wouldn't so much be legislating. Presumably there would
be a
registry out there. The judge would determine if the person should be subjected to it and under what conditions, and using individualized discretion. But our country, in most instances, has been moving more and more away from that discretion. That's mm-hmm. what started in the 1980s with the Sentencing Reform Act of 84. That's how we end up with the federal sentencing guidelines, because there was too much judicial discretion as far as the conservatives were concerned, and they put this more of a cash register approach into place. And states have followed suit, and the judges have far less discretion.
Right.
Far less discretion than they once did. And this judge in this particular case got blasted by the sheriff in that jurisdiction, because he found a particular registration case, a charge for violating the registry, to be weak, and he set a $10 bond.
Right.
And he got blasted for that. I mean, he could have just OR'd the person.
Yep.
I'm presuming they have that option in Indiana. And if they don't, then that may be why he set the $10 bond. But then he gets blasted for doing that. And so next thing you know, there'll be an enterprising lawmaker in Indiana that'll come in and say for sex offender registry violations that they'll take the discretion for setting bond away from judges. That's
right.
The risk when you take a stand like that. That's what will happen. And they've done that. We've got a state that I know of right away. I've worked closely with Maryland. They don't even allow. They have what they call district court commissioners that are on duty to set bonds for people as they're arrested. And the district court commissioner can't set bonds for certain type of offenses. And one of them is for anybody that's required to register. So they have to wait and see a judge, which delays them getting a bond set. Mm-hmm. Now, they still may get a bond set, but the commissioner can't set it.
Right.
And the equivalent in Georgia, I think, would be that they have magistrates that set judges. And in Georgia, at one time, these magistrate judges, maybe they don't do it so much anymore, but they actually used to just go into the jail and talk to the person on a very formal basis and ask them about themselves. And then they'd say, I'm going to set a $500 bond for you.
Right.
And they still do that in smaller counties.
Yeah, and they may. And that's what I'm going after, though, is that I'm trying to find the balance between what the quote-unquote will of the people is and them voting for the legislators, and them coming down with what is supposed to be followed, and then taking away the judge's discretion of being, that they're not intimately involved in what's going on, but they certainly know more than it just being a blanket rule than the legislators. The legislators are making rules for 10 million people, and the judge is dealing with you. So that guy knows your situation and can read into you, knows what the facts are, blah, 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 and can make a discretion of whether you should have lifetime registration or if you get $10 bond. I mean, that's kind of the two extremes of what they could sentence you to.
Well, But when you hype the people up, see, the sheriff already had started the hyping, and he's got access to the media, because usually if a sheriff is close enough to a media market, if they're way out in the rural area where there really is no media, but if they're in a media market, if the sheriff wants to say something, the media is very responsive. I mean, that's news. So the sheriff has already fired the salvo criticizing Judge Kirsch for setting the $10 bond. And the logical progression of that will be that there'll be a piece of legislation introduced to prevent judges from being able to do a $10 bond on the registry. The lawmakers will either say that there's no bond until X, Y, and Z happens, or that minimum bond is whatever. But the sheriff fired the first shot in this battle, and Judge Kirsch, who knows what will happen to him when he has to face election again. But the will of the people is what ultimately is going to determine this. If people call the sheriff and say, "You're wrong, brother. He should have gotten a $10 bond," and I find it very distasteful that you're attacking Judge Kirsch, the sheriff will shut up. If he starts getting all sorts of phone calls in the TV stations saying, "Hooray, it's about time somebody stood up for victims," that's going to be what drives this process. It's the will of the people. And,
right.
And so I tell the people in Indiana where this is happening, you need to make your voice heard. You need to support Judge Kirsch.
Yeah.
And the analogy will be the judge the Brock Turner case. He's subject to recall right now.
Right.
I'm putting my odds on him being recalled.
Okay.
Because the people have been whipped up to a frenzy about he shouldn't have given such a light sentence. They didn't want him to have judicial discretion, and they have since removed that judicial discretion.
Yeah.
That there's a minimum sentence now where no one could ever get the sentence that Brock Turner got again. That's what happens to people who speak up and do the right thing.
Sure. And then we collectively...
That's what can't happen. I can't say it always happens.
Sure. And then we collectively don't stand up and try and support someone like Judge Kirsch to, you know, show support for him so they would continue making those decisions. I guess that's really like ultimately where this goes, is that we don't go and support our politicians that would support us. And the other side is definitely making an uproar, and so the politicians then support that side.
Well, if your podcast research assistants have time to contact Judge Kirsch's office, I'd be curious to know how many favorable phone calls he's got compared to how many irate phone calls he's got about setting a $10 bond and about his decision. And I just about bet you there's a whole lot more people angry than that are saying, "Oh, way to go."
Isn't that an argument for judges being appointed and then so they're not accountable to the political process?
That is an argument for that. But then the counter argument to that is that then these people are there for life and they answer to nobody, and then they could do more Brock Turners, and we don't want that, do we?
Isn't that the intent, that they are like stalwarts? It's almost like a teacher getting tenure at a school that they can then publish and be intellectually honest and say things that might not be popular. Isn't that the intent behind the system, the way it was designed?
Oh, that's the intent where the judges are appointed. That is exactly no. But like I say, many states are not appointed. Your state, they're not.
Right.
Our state has a hybrid system where they're appointed and elected. But there's a lot of states where judges run for office, and they don't promise people, generally speaking, how lenient they're going to be when they're running.
Explain that.
Well, when you're running for judge, if you go out on a campaign, so I'll tell you one thing, if you elect me, I'm going to do my very best not to send people to prison. I'm going to look for alternatives to incarceration. I can't think of the last time I've seen that as a platform.
Yeah, and that guy doesn't get elected if they do stand on that platform.
So now you might get away with being a little creative in a more urban progressive area. I mean, if you're running for judge in DeKalb, I always pick on your state because, you know, if you're running a judge for DeKalb, which is Metro Atlanta or Fulton, you might get away with expressing that type of sentiment. But if you're running for a judge in Sumter County, which is where Jimmy Carter's from, that probably won't get you a lot of votes.
Right.
Or Paulding County or Cherokee County, those northern counties that are far more conservative.
Certainly. And from the progress, Governor Wolf signs bill to protect victims of sexual abuse crimes. Governor Tom Wolf on Wednesday signed House Bill 631 into law, the primary intent of which is to provide for greater public safety by ensuring convicted sexual offenders remain subject to registration requirements in the wake of recent court decision impacting Pennsylvania's implementation of the Sexual Offender Registration and Notification Act. So, this is the 2012 adjustment. I think they call, is that Megan's 3? Is that what it's called, Megan's Law 3? Or is it 2?
They referred to it as a SORNA. The Megan's, they had 3 versions of Megan's Law. And then when they passed requirements, they referred to that as SORNA.
Okay. And so this was, if you were sentenced after 2012, this is the Muniz case is what this boils down to. So, and we reported a week or so ago that the House had unanimously voted. So here it is that the governor then signed it.
So yes, it actually, that bill, I believe that was House Bill 1952, if I remember my numbers correctly. That bill was actually rolled into another bill, which is a 100-page monstrosity of dealing with, they took a cut and pasted 1952 into to a more comprehensive bill that dealt with other issues. And they passed it, and it made its way through the process and to the governor. And we had a discussion on the last Narsal in Action phone call about whether he would sign it or whether he would veto it. And I predicted that he would sign it, and we could go into the reasons why he signed it. But if you like, but that was not unexpected on my part.
Well, the short answer, I think we covered that it was unanimously signed for by the legislature.
Well, that's the short answer. The longer answer is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in the Muniz case issued a decision that said you went too far. You can't apply this version to anyone whose crime occurred before then. So what you have is a situation where there would be thousands of people that would no longer be subject to registration, period. So they could have been, at the time 2012 went into effect, they could have been 1 year into their 10-year, what was a 10-year registration obligation at that time. And by this decision, they would be done altogether. And I didn't think it was likely that public opinion would tolerate those people just vanishing from the registry altogether because it declared the law invalid, period. So it couldn't be applied to anybody. There was potentially a fallback position that our attorney on the call explained that I can't quite explain as well as she did, so I won't try. Mm-hmm. But arguably, there was no registration requirement at all, right. And the state wasn't likely to tolerate that. So then, as the fix went through, which was this was to restore registration, this fix is going to put people back to their original terms that they had. And so in some cases, people were in year 7, 8, or 9, they would already be done. But this is going to roll people back, as I understand it, to the time that they previously had under the pre-SORNA, under the Megan's Law that was in effect. And then people who didn't have a registration obligation before they declared that their crimes would now be registrable, I think it will roll them off the registry as well. But it will restore registration for a lot of people. But people will get off because they will have timed out under the original 10 years, and those people were moved up to 15, 25 in life. So there will be a lot of people who will have timed out because this litigation has been running now for almost 6 years. So right. this took effect December of 12, and here we are in February of 18. So we're in 5+ years of since this. So a lot of people will have rolled through the end of their 10 years. So people will get off, but this is not the end of this battle because there may be some defects. They might have gone further than what they can go,
right?
And we'll explore that more on Wednesday night on the phone call if we can get concise answers. This is such a complex bill that
yep.
that as of right now we don't have all the answers. But it may be that people get off the registry and live happily ever after, and it may be that they've created a new registration obligation that's less onerous that has to be challenged again. I just don't know the answer to all that. But
yeah, sure.
I expected the governor to sign it because it passed unanimously. And as far as the governor was concerned, no one had told and convinced the governor there was anything wrong with this till it gets to his desk. And by the time something gets to an executive's desk, if there's no controversy about it and there's no reason for them to believe that there's any problem with it, they're going to sign it.
Yeah.
So that's how you know it's going to be signed, is if there's no opposition And no one has got to convince the governor before it reaches them that there's problems. When you go to the governor after it's passed unanimously, or the president, or whoever the executive is, and say, oh, sir, madam, there are big problems with this. And he'll say, well, did any of those questions arise during the process of it? Well, no, sir. It's just that's not likely to happen. So my prediction was that he would sign it, and he did.
Sure. This is from The Independent. Changes are coming to California's sex offender registry. A new approach will consider the severity of the crimes. California will use a tier system. Deputy Public Defender Laura Arnold argued the state spends exorbitant resources every year monitoring sex offenders, even though they only make up a tiny fraction of those who have committed a dangerous crime and are likely to reoffend. I don't know that we've covered tier things on this program. I know that I've heard about the amount of resources that it takes to do a tier system. But here it is, California. I'm going to assume they have the largest number of people on the registry just because they have the most people in the country. But do tier systems make any difference in the grand scheme of things for our people?
Well, they can't, depending on how they're done. There's tiers that can be achieved by an individualized risk assessment, and then there's the tiers that can be assigned by an arbitrary offense category. That you did it by this offense falls into this tier. And so that's one of the big beefs about the Adam Walsh Act is that they tier the offense based on if it's a misdemeanor, it's a tier one. Then it can be a felony if it carries a year or less than a year of a potential maximum penalty of incarceration. Then if it's a felony level offense, it's a tier two, unless it involves physical violence or a victim under 12. So those need to be tiered at a level two, and then those others would be level three. Well, what happens is under those models, a lot of people get put into tier three that really don't have to be because they put all crimes against a minor in tier three, and they don't have to be. They'd had to have had either violence or they would have had to have been under 12.
Right.
So, but they end up with a lot of people in tier three that really don't have to be. So, but here's why I would answer that question. It's specific to the state. If you've got a state like California where everyone has to register for life,
right,
assuming that you don't put everyone in tier three, which is the lifetime, assuming that at least one person was tiered at level one or two, it would be an improvement for that one person. That's being silly. We're going to assume that a whole lot more than one get assigned a tier designation of one or two. So regardless of which methodology you use, if you get people where they no longer have to register for life, it would be an improvement, whether it's a risk-based system or whether it's an offense-based system, because you're looking at what you're comparing it against. So if you have no hope of getting off, which in the current California law you don't, well, this would clearly be an improvement. But that's not where it ends. It ends because the process they put in place is so fundamentally flawed that it would be very rare that anyone will get off unless they change this. Anyone, because the way I understood it, and this is don't hold me to it because I haven't read this in a while, but the way I understood it was that the person has to file a petition. They don't just automatically roll off. So once they get this tiering system in place by whatever methodology they're going to use and have it up and running by 2021, then you have to, if you're a tier one, you don't just magically vanish. You have to file a petition and you have to serve it on the police, the law enforcement, and then they have to do their background check. And then it goes to the prosecutor's office, and the prosecutor can object. And there's a hearing process, and the burden is entirely on the registered citizen. So my prediction is that so few people will get off that even though there's a tier system, that this will be a very little benefit. And they'll have to, if the goal was to get people off, then they're going to have to go back and tweak this. Our feedback from people who advocate in California is that this whole system is screwed. It's poorly designed. And it's one step above having nothing.
Got it. So a bit of a pipe dream, I guess, is one way to put it. Pie
well,
in the
I
sky.
Well, I get criticized for being negative, so I'm not trying to be negative. I'm telling you that It is better than having no system at all.
Right.
If there is a process to get people off, and it's a lifetime requirement without that, a theoretical process is better than no process. You'd have to concede that. But it's a deeply flawed process. And that's what gives me concern, because I don't believe anybody will be able to jump through the hoops the way they set them up. Very few people.
The next one on the list is a clip. It's about 2 minutes long. I'd encourage everyone to get the link out of the show notes on the website. And the short story is that her son was sentenced to 40 years. He was sentenced at the age of 18, but when he was 14, he had ended up with what probably is child porn. But then when he was 18, they arrested him. So when he was 19, he's overwhelmed with guilt and depression. Prosecutors asked him horrific questions about the age and the sex that he prefers, if he prefers boys or girls, or does he prefer them 2 or 12? And ultimately, the kid commits suicide. And I'm trying to think of another situation like that where the amount of pressure that they... Oh, you know what? Oh, this was... there was a... it was a computer geek kid. I want to say he was an MIT student, and he had gone out and he downloaded a bunch of documents from a college's website and was releasing that to make it public access. And, you know, we could argue whether that was legal or not, but the feds put so much pressure on him. Alan Schwartz, I think is the guy's name. They put so much pressure on him. He commits suicide. And there's a troubling piece of our system for the prosecutors to put that much pressure on someone that they cave and commit suicide.
Yes, this was a tragic story as well. I guess the guy was 20 when he committed suicide, and the questions that his probation officer, I think you said prosecutor, but the probation officers, according to his mother's account, was asking are just terrible things to ask a person. And the problem for him was that if the possession is a continuing offense, so as long as you have possession, so if he collected these images or moving videos or whatever they were, if he collected these when he was 14 and he continued to possess them, then he was in fact in possession when he was over 18, which permitted him to be prosecuted as an adult. Did they deliberately wait till he was 18? No one knows.
Right.
I mean, but they know, but none of us know if they deliberately did that. It's possible. But even if they didn't do that, what they impose on these people, it's unbelievable. I tell people with all the requirements that they have of their counseling, which the counseling in most instances is nothing more than a collaborative fishing expedition to try to sink a person. But with the counseling cost, the polygraph cost, the very, very harsh treatment they receive with very little consideration about appointments. You'll be at my office at 8:30 tomorrow. Well, I have to be at work at 8. Your problem. Be here or else
right.
We'll violate you.
Right.
With that mentality, I'm surprised that as many people make it through as they do.
Yeah.
Because it's not about rehabilitation. It's about an I got you moment.
Yep.
And that's sad, because as collectively as society, we don't benefit by playing this game with people. We benefit by getting them in bona fide, legitimate treatment that's not a collaborative fishing expedition to deal with their deviant thoughts and to try to make them a wholly functional part of society. We don't benefit by having them in an incarceration setting, paying for years and years of upkeep, and we don't benefit by having them under bridges. Well, for some reason, we can't grasp that concept, and I don't understand. It's not complicated, but we can't get it.
Right. Just to, I mentioned this guy, Schwartz. His name's Aaron Schwartz, and forgive me for going down a little bit of a tech path. But he was involved in creating some of the really RSS feeds, which is what makes podcasts possible. And he was one of the creators of the site Reddit, which is considered the front page of the internet at this point. And so he went and downloaded some information from the MIT website, and he got arrested for that. And the cumulative maximum penalty was $1 million fine and 35 years in prison, asset forfeiture, restitution, and supervised release. And then he kills himself. And there's a little more to the story, so go look at Aaron Schwartz on Wikipedia. But they apply so much pressure to you, and this isn't even for a sex offense. This is for wire fraud, downloading stuff off the internet. And they negotiated him into killing himself, into suicide. And it's just horrible. I can't see. I mean, these crimes don't aspire to the death penalty, but that's what they end up bringing about.
So,
anywho,
that says a little bit about our gentle nature as Americans.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we'll get a plethora of criticism for saying that, but Americans really do need to take a look and figure out if what we're doing is the prudent course of action for the collective good. We're all in this together, folks.
Yeah. We are going to rise or we're going to fail together. And if we throw people under the bus as we're going down, I don't see how that benefits us. So you wanted me to put this one on there. So this is from the Daily Beast. Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, forgive me, I did hear it, and I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It's Greitens or Greitens, indicted for taking nude photo of woman without consent, according to prosecutors. Greitens knowingly photographed the woman while she was nude and had a reasonable expectation of privacy, Greitens said. My confidence in our prosecutorial system is shaken, but not broken. So a guy kind of high on the hog is going to be one of our people.
Possibly. Now, there'll be people out there who'll say that he'll get all kind of special treatment and consideration, and he probably will. Give you an example, when the average person's arrested, they go in with a Gestapo unit,
yeah,
practically, and this they allowed him to surrender himself, and they did the processing and released him on his own recognizance. Well, there's some bias there because of the gentle nature which he was processed and then his own recognizance, but you have to take it into consideration. It's very difficult for him to vanish. He's got a significant role in government. Unless he just wants to abandon his governorship, it's going to be pretty easy for us to locate. So personal recognizance is probably quite sufficient. Be curious to know if they require him to surrender his passport, which is very common these days. Be curious to know if they forbid any out of state travel, which is common, and sometimes even out of the county travel while a person's on conditions of release. Don't have that information, but I'd be curious to know what type of conditions of release. It was just straight personal recognizance, and that was it, or if they imposed any conditions. But he will potentially have a lot of controversy around this because he's a sitting chief executive, and he's under criminal indictment, and it's going to be a major distraction. No matter how much he wants to go on with business as usual, to be facing the wrath of a felony. And he's already alleged that it's politically motivated because the prosecutor is a Democrat and he's Republican.
And it's reportedly like a rising star, you know, to go to the topest echelons of the government.
So I will be watching this with great interest of how it unfolds and what happens to the governor.
Going back to some of the other conversations we had about being able to go past your past, he's also a former Navy SEAL. I mean, they don't get really any more elite than that.
So, while I'm not sure how much that'll play into the prosecutor's thinking, it will play into the sentencing phase. I mean, he'll be recognized, hopefully, if this should result in a conviction. We just don't know how it's going to play out. He has to avail himself to the right to go to trial or the right to work out a plea agreement and see if he can find out some way, but this only happened in 2015, so it's not that long ago. I believe it was 2015 the allegations rest upon.
Right.
It was before his governorship, but it wasn't very long ago.
Yeah. So this was a little off topic, but we fight so often to get our side of the story out about recidivism rates or things of that nature, and you would find people possibly classify the sex crime numbers as being fake news. So this kind of popped up where an incredibly prominent radio host made a statement, and you called him on it and said, there's no effing way that that's possible, that that's the number. So I dug around, I got the clip, and I don't know how else to fact check this, but I'm going to play the clip.
Well, don't play it just yet. I would say that first of all, before we play the clip, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the cast.
Yep.
That would be Andy and Larry. We do not speak for an organization unless we say specifically we are.
Nor are we affiliated with direct. I mean, we have our affiliations, but this is not affiliated. This is solely our own.
So with that being said, the fake news is a significant part of the problem. We battle fake news with our issue. The whole country is just filled with fake news.
Yeah.
But this prominent radio show host that has 30 million listeners or so, he claims, he's very critical of what he calls the drive-by media and fake news. So I happen to be listening Friday afternoon because I've listened to a balanced, I listen to liberal and conservative. I read liberal and conservative. I try my best to get as much information as I can to be fully informed. And I heard something that was just so ridiculous that I couldn't believe I heard it. So, but we actually are going to play it. But this is what I heard. And this is from a person who criticizes fake news. And he's disseminating so much misinformation that this was actually a pathetic thing to do. And I hope he gets called out on it.
But more people are killed by knives every year than guns. Do you know that? You know how many people die every year from knives? 250,000 people lose their lives to knives.
Okay, so I did as much research as I could find to figure out how he would have come up with this number. And short of having the source of information, going to the CDC's website and just listing deaths. How do people die in the United States? And I will only have to read the top three. The first one is heart disease, and it's 630,000 people. The second one is cancer at just under 600,000 people. Chronic lower respiratory disease, I really don't know what that means, 150,000 people. There's a number missing there, which should be something like 250,000 people die of knives. This isn't homicides. This isn't, I mean, you know, you're at home and you're cutting yourself, I mean, you're cutting your dinner with a good knife and something happens and you bleed out. I guess that would be, I mean, you could die of some sort of home injury in that respect. But that number isn't there. There's no 250,000 people listed right below cancer as being something along the lines death by knife.
Well, in the clip, you didn't put it in the context. He was talking about people being killed by knives in a homicidal fashion because this was about the gun debate.
Correct.
So he was saying that the people who want to restrict guns should be going for knives because there's more people killed at the hands of wielding knives. And we don't even have... But 17, 18, 20,000 homicides a year in the entire country.
Correct.
So when I heard that 250,000 number, I thought, well, now this is just so over the top. But people who follow this host and they believe in this host, they're not even going to take the time to even doubt or question it.
And they'll just regurgitate that number.
Yes, they will. You will start hearing people talk in the coming weeks, well, why are we talking about guns when 250,000 people die at knives? But it's just simply not true. And for those who didn't catch the voice of the host, that is none other than Rush Limbaugh. And Rush, you shouldn't be giving misinformation out like that because you're the critic of fake news. And you're disseminating misinformation, grossly misinforming your listeners. And it's a tragedy, but our podcast is not going to reach very many of his supporters. But I'm hoping we're reaching a few, and I'm hoping those few will go back and possibly try to call 1-800-282-2882 and see if they can get through and correct him on his misinformation, because there's no evidence that I can find or that Andy can find that 250,000 people are killed by knives in the United States of America.
Thank you to our patrons. Thank you for helping support our efforts. And thank you, Dave, for becoming a patron over at patreon.com/registrymatters. The phone number is 747-227-4477. That's how you can leave a voicemail message, which we have one coming up here in a second. The email address is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can fill out like the contact block. It's, I'm pretty sure it's on the bottom left side of the website, and that's registrymatters.co. We do have a voicemail message.
I thought we got some messages this week, and we even got a person that signed up to support the podcast.
We did. That's Dave.
Thank you, Dave. So we're gratified that you really appreciate what we're doing.
And he had very nice things to say about us. So we did get a phone call. We have a question, and I think you're gonna have fun with this, Larry.
Hello, my name's Tom. I'm on sex offender probation. I was just curious, what happens if I stop paying my fine or pay late all the time? There is no benefit for me to pay on time and stay in good standings because there is no reward for good time. So what happens if I happen to pay late every month or stop paying for a few months? Anyways, just curious what the consequences would be or how that ends up. Thanks for your time.
So just for a little clarification, it's not just it's the monthly probation fee that he's talking about. I spoke to him, and he did a little clarification there.
Well, he did label it as a fine, so I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah.
So, well, it would be jurisdiction specific. If it's a willful, I would pull my jurisdiction, which I'm most familiar with. If frequently they waive those supervision cost if the person's enrolled in school, and the judges oftentimes at the onset of sentencing, if it's a probating sentence, they'll say if the person is in school and certain other criteria that they won't have to pay supervision fees. But it was going to depend on the aggressive nature of the jurisdiction he's in and how relentless they want to pursue a violation. But failure to pay supervision cost is a technical violation of probation. So I would not encourage anyone to willfully do that. If you're not able to make the payments, truly not able despite your best efforts, but it would be something that would subject a person to a potential notification to a court and a potential revocation action to not pay supervision costs.
So to his point, though, you aren't rewarded for good behavior, but you're certainly punished for bad behavior.
Well, I don't know what you mean. You're not rewarded. The reward you get is you continue to serve your sentence in the community by complying with the conditions of probation. Isn't that a form of a reward?
Certainly. It just doesn't seem to get better over time. It's, you know, you're just almost like Groundhog Day.
Well, there was a time when probation did get a lot better as they got to know you and feel comfortable with you. I think that those days for people on sex offender probation, it's the difference between initial supervision and years into it sometimes can be almost imperceptible because they're so tough. But even in the states like mine where they're very tough on sex offenders, we do have a level system of supervision. So you do work your way up through levels of supervision where there are a little bit more freedoms afforded to a person.
Got it.
So the curfew would go from like 6 o'clock on the initial supervision level to, I believe it's either 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Now, a lot of offenders have no curfew at all, so it doesn't sound so attractive, but then the frequency of reporting can be dropped, you know, from weekly to monthly to sometimes maybe even less than monthly. So there is some reward, but paying supervision costs is failure to do so could result in an action. So I would strongly discourage that.
Very good. Hey, Tom, thank you very much for calling in. And that's 747-227-4477. If you have a question, and maybe we'll answer it.
We'll do our best. We love questions.
Absolutely.
The registry matters. Did we talk about the registry tonight, Andy?
The actual registry?
Not much. We talked about the Pennsylvania situation. We talked about so many things, but I guess these are all registry matters related.
I think they're
except
all
for the Rush. The only thing about Rush, I'll clarify before we get 100 complaints, is that fake news is a problem.
Yes.
And large platforms like what he has, that's terrible to be conveying that fake information about guns versus knives. So it's not to deliberately bash Rush, although I did do that because I felt it was irresponsible. But fake news is a problem. We need to spend time to validate our news sources. And for those who listen to this, if we've got something wrong, please let us know. If we're factually wrong, we're going to come back. In fact, I thought it was something I was going to try to correct this week that I don't remember what it was. But
there was an errata, wasn't there? I don't remember what it was.
But we're trying our best to be accurate and correct. And if we've got something wrong factually, by all means, let us know.
And closing out, we're running incredibly long. Well, like I said, we've run long. We're around 90 minutes on this episode. By the time I do some cutting out, it probably will only cut out about 5 or 10 minutes. And I thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Andy.
Have a great night.
Good night.
Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 13. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.